Good evening, Los Angeles. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio. I'm Nicholas Miller, here with my tireless co-host, Stephen Cato.
Hey. Yeah, well, you know, I wouldn't go all the way to tireless, not after last week's epic performance by Phil Elverum. You know, after staying up all night, you know, the body's just not used to that kind of thing, and I think I almost slept for the whole week, actually, between shows. Anyway, Nicholas, why don't you talk about today's show a little bit?
And we have an incredible show for you today. Something we've not really done on the talking show before. We've done all sorts of talking, but nothing that quite resembles this. We're going to do a straight-up artist talk. That's right, an artist talking about his or her work, and maybe connecting it to other forms of expression like literature, philosophy, couching it in historical context, you know, kind of lending you an understanding of what they do. I suppose we had that Carl Andre thing a while ago, right, Steve?
Yeah, although that wasn't really a talk so much as it was sort of a hybrid talk and performance by the famous artist and murderer Carl Andre.
Yeah, I remember you were really fond of that one. Well, this one's going to be a little bit different because this is a much younger artist, much more vibrant and intellectually engaged than, you know, Mr. Andre was, although that talk was riveting.
You know, I wouldn't say that Carl Andre was unengaged. I mean, he was actually, I think, rather sympathetic in terms of how he expressed himself and was certainly concerned with politics and the world at large in terms of his own work as well. I think you're being a little unfair to a man who, despite his other obvious shortcomings, is, you know, at least engaged in a political context, at least.
Okay, well, let's get right to it. All the way from Berlin, Germany, by way of Canada, we have the ineffable and sometimes militant Charles Stankovich.
Mr. Whitehead was like giving me a heads up on the warning, so thanks. I'm going to be talking about a couple of my projects this morning, the Dew Project and Ghost Rockets, mostly within a context of the history of where I've been living the last 3 years. So we got a little bit of text cut off there, but I think you can figure out what the end of that is. The format for the lecture today was something I've been thinking about for a little bit, how to present all of these ideas, some of my own work, some of my own research, and also the bleed of the boundary between those two that I like to confuse or conflate all the time. So I thought perhaps I'd go back and steal something from one of my heroes, Glenn Gould, and pervert it a little bit more. I moved up to the north to the Yukon 3 years ago, and I'll get into that a little bit later, and I think this is probably one of the reasons that drew me up there, the romanticism of this work. And of course, I think Frank's going to talk about this later on in the conference. Oh, thank you. Maybe we can just shift the projector over a tiny bit. Great, thanks. We'll get it all figured out here. I'm just warming up. So I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later in another talk, but this idea of polyphony, or the fugue for the radio documentary, and this kind of idea to mix things up a bit, I decided for my talk today I'm going to do a radio scan for my structure. Essentially, just imagine today I'm going to be starting at 88 and sliding all the way up to 108. We're going to get some noise, some fiction, maybe some spoken word, maybe even a few facts. So that's kind of the form I'm going to take today. We're going to jump around, but basically try to move through history from the cosmic to the 21st century and possibly beyond, back to the cosmic, who knows. So that's the schematic on the top there, the four projects I might get time to talk about today. Within the spectrum is the dates and kind of what was going on at those dates that is important to what I'm talking about. And then the bottom is essentially the particulars of those time periods and how the electromagnetic was kind of being used or experimented with during those times. So that's kind of the master plan for today, and I'll try to get through it in an hour. So the North, most people, when I tell them that I've been living up there for a bit, they usually respond by asking about the Northern Lights and asking me how they are. I get the occasional email on how to record them and photograph them, etc. And for good reason. It's definitely one of the most amazing things in that region of the world. And this is a picture from STS 117, I believe, the mission from the space shuttle. And so I think it's always surprising for people to see that they're about 50 kilometers up in the air. They don't seem that far when you're actually being surrounded by them. And I made a recording of them that I thought I'll just play in the background here in, I think it was about April or May. This is a K7 magnetic storm that I recorded in the Tombstone Mountains, which is about an hour north of Dawson City. So you're kind of hearing the snaps and pops of lightning hitting the magnetic sphere somewhere around the Earth and traveling all around. As well, you hear the navigation signal in the background as well. So I'm going to read a few chunks of text that are pulled out of some publications I've written in the last year, some definitions for glossary terms kind of interspliced throughout. So the first one is the aurora borealis. Whether believed to be spirits traveling across the sky or solar radiation colliding with the magnetosphere, the Northern Lights have captured the imagination of elders, explorers, scientists, tourists, and artists alike. Before this past century, we did not have a clear understanding that solar radiation interacting with the magnetic sphere created such luminescent skies. And with this epistemological gap, folklore explanations flourished, ranging from ghost stories to people claiming they can hear them. Nowadays, we can create the outer space rock and roll light show artificially with high-powered ionospheric radio experiments like the High Frequency Active Aurora Research Project, also known as HARP, or high-altitude nuclear explosions. And I should mention that since I've moved up there, it's been kind of interesting for me to find out through oral tradition that there's a long history of the Northern Lights being manifestations of ancestors coming back to talk to those kind of left still on the Earth. And you can converse with them then. And this is somewhat of the reason why I think some people think they can tune in and hear what they have to say, or at least think that they make sound that they can acoustically hear. And it's them whispering back. And that kind of echo location, or let's say kind of almost proto-radar of send and receive in the electromagnetic spheres, a theme I'll definitely be touching on for the rest of the talk. The image you're looking at right now is, I believe the correct name is Blue Starfish, but this is a U.S. military high-altitude nuclear explosion up in the ionosphere and the magnetic sphere. And so when the nuclear explosion ruptures, it charges and sends out these artificial northern lights. The other thing that I think most people would be accessing the electromagnetics of the North would, of course, be magnetic North itself. And so this is one of the most beautiful objects I think I've ever physically laid eyes on. Unfortunately, the reproduction doesn't do it justice, but you can, I think, get the rough idea. This is a map from 1595 by Mercator that's at the National Archives of Canada. I had the fortunate opportunity to curate it at a show in Montreal and meet it halfway, shall we say, between where it was stored and where I was living to see it with my own eyes. And the colors are amazing. And the ideas going on and what this represents for me really almost spawned a whole show called Magnetic North that I curated in Montreal at the Leonard Bean Allen Gallery from February to April. And the trope of the show was right in the center and, let's say, 1 o'clock on the map. And what was interesting is that this was a map made at the time of the most, you know, advanced data collection and theories for cartography by Mercator, which kind of was an extension out of this map here from 1569, which is the first Mercator projection, which is what most of us probably grew up with our scholastic maps on the walls of flattening the Earth into this grid-like system. But you'll notice, of course, that the North gets expanded quite a lot. Even the North Pole becomes this infinite line on the top of the map. So he breaks out a detail down in this corner of the North Pole, which is what's been reproduced in this map a couple years later, pretty much verbatim, just with some color. So it's got all this scientific information with utilitarian object, obviously, for exploration and conquering and economic means. But at the same time, it's full of fantasy. First of all, I mean, probably what most people notice is that there aren't four continents at the North Pole, just a nice cap. Also, there isn't a whirlwind, and there's not a big, large magnetic mountain, which kind of extends out of medieval philosophy that our compasses point to the North Pole because there's a large lodestone there. What's neat about this map, because this is actually quite old thinking, is that they notice magnetic declination, or why magnetic north doesn't point to celestial north being, of course, the top of the axis of the spinning of the Earth. And so to account for that, he posited a second north, magnetic north pole here. And it's kind of the warring between these two magnetic mountains that would account for the magnetic north that the compasses point to somewhere around here, where it's moving today towards Siberia from, let's say, disputed Canadian waters. So that was something that became a big and a very important trope for me of the different types of fields and references and almost conflicts that exist in there of fantasy space and real space, both military and developmental, as well as the traditions and the beauty. I want to kind of move now into man-made radio waves instead of, I guess, the natural ones from the Earth and from the Sun. And I'll do that by reading a text on radio. Precipitated by the Klondike Gold Rush, the U.S. Army started experimenting with wireless technology in Alaska, and possibly the Yukon, as precise maps were just being drafted on the disputed region at the time. Appropriating the derelict overland telegraph line from the mid-19th century, by 1902, the Army worked with Marconi's company to complete the system with wireless telegraphy connections between remote bases, creating one of the earliest wireless communication networks connecting the Arctic to the rest of the continent. Eventually, the system would evolve into the ionosphere troposcatter networks of White Alice and the Dew Line before rising upwards into satellites. Today, HARP is the next generation experimental radio research station buried away in the interior of Alaska, a few hours from the Canadian border, and shrouded in a veil of mystery. On the civilian front, CBC links the northern landscape together with its nationalistic broadcast connecting isolated communities across the vast, and I would also say sublime, landscape. So I have some clippings from the New York Times dating from about 1895 to 1902 that kind of trace this development out. First of all, there was the use of the derelict telegraph line that they wanted to use, right? Remember, North America wanted to communicate with Europe, so they needed to build a telegraph, and they thought the best way to do this was through the Bering Strait, as that was the smallest expanse of ocean to cover. But then they dropped the Atlantic cable, and that made that a moot kind of construction. It was abandoned and actually, reclaimed for the wood and the wires to make snowshoes and fire. So the actual telegraph disappeared, but the mapping, the surveying, this idea of setting it up was then borrowed as soon as the Klondike Gold Rush started at the end of the 19th century, and pretty much one of the most important places in the world at the time. There's weekly articles in the New York Times on it. The Guggenheims are there investing. It was the largest city, of course, north of Seattle and west of Winnipeg, with 40,000 people there just for a few years. So the desire for communication to get this industry to the market as quick as possible was incredibly important. At the same time, there was issues of sovereignty. Where was the boundary between Alaska and Yukon? And of course, with the gold fields there, everyone kind of wanted a piece of that pie. So these issues all became of importance. So we kind of move forward a couple years, and there's a promise of building this telegraph. I love this line. It's actually on one of my websites for a student project I'll talk about in a little bit. I love this part, that a distance of nearly 100 miles so that communication may be had with the interior of the Yukon all year round. This would place the Klondike within a couple weeks travel of communication with the outside world. So that seemed fast back then. Of course, the irony of the last line, so far no reply has been received from Washington, always makes me laugh. We quickly move into wireless telegraphy, and Alaska is basically here with the U.S. Army developing this. And the key part in this passage here is that telegraph didn't really work because the landscape was so large, so vast, and the conditions were so extreme that the ice and the weather and so forth kept maintenance from these things working. So essentially they had to move to wireless to make things function, which still exists today. The North is wired through microwave towers and satellites and so forth. There's not a lot of landlines to connect this vast space for the very, very small population that live up there. This is a lovely little book that was given to me by a friend who bought it in an estate sale. I think the date's 1922. I just love the cover and particularly the title, Radio Miracle of the 20th Century, being a vivid, authentic, and intensely interesting story of radio communication and the remarkable accomplishments of men who have made it possible to talk through space to people miles away. It's a beautiful book, and what I wanted to read particularly out of it is this passage called Radio Might Save Explorers. But far and beyond this, the radio and the airplane together will make possible to chart and map parts of the great world as yet uncharted. Not much of the big sphere remains untouched by modern man, but many places have not been charted because the knowledge of precise time is essential to the work. Where wire communication is had with Greenwich, the information contained from that center is used to determine both time and space, but Greenwich could not therefore or hereto be reached from the North Pole or great frozen zones at the end of the Earth. The wireless will make it possible for the geographer to obtain time and necessary information from Greenwich and make exact scientific reports that will eliminate all questions of doubt as to the precise location of any portion of the Earth that they have then reached. So I think time is really important there, and the synchronicity that wireless can give for a global understanding of exploring and mapping. I'm just going to skip to the end of that paragraph, or end of that page. And if speculations may enter into our calculations, they may carry us to other realms in the effort to communicate with Mars, which has been going on for years, may be solved by the radio. There are those two who accept the proof of wireless communication as evidence that the contentions of the spiritualists are correct, and that it is possible to communicate with spirits beyond the Styx, the other world, and that a new science is being developed which will open wide to the world a book that has been for centuries has been a closed volume. And I'll kind of get back to that a little bit later in the presentation. CBC. I can't really talk about the North and radio without talking about CBC. That's the logo from 1940 to 1957. CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, is a crown corporation created in 1936 and utilizes the nationalist propaganda media network via radio and TV, and now additionally via the internet and satellite radio. The CBC has a special division for the North that includes custom programming for the region with attention to local community events and languages. Over the years, CBC has commissioned a host of new compositions such as Armory Schaeffer's North White for orchestra and snow machine, and produced a variety of ethnomusic recordings as well as a number of radio and TV documentaries, including Glenn Gould's seminal idea of North Radio documentary from 1967, which I showed some images and a sketch from at the beginning. Here's some images from the National Archives of radio stations throughout the Arctic. This is Arctic Bay. This is Nunavut Community Station. This is Ross River. I have a weekly radio show in Dawson City on CFYT 106.9, which is the Canadian Forces Yukon Territory, old frequency. And so it's community radio, something that's been fun for me to explore up there, both as a listener and producer. Kind of moving along, this is today. This is my classroom in Dawson City at the Kayak School of Visual Arts, which is a project that I got involved in 3 years ago with a group of people to co-found the most northern accredited art school in Canada. We offer a BFA and then transfer to some other institutions, one of them being here in town, OCAD. And what makes it possible is video conferencing. It's distributed learning is something that is established quite thoroughly in the Arctic, much more than it is in the South. And we actually have people in the South asking us and learning about how it's done, because it's just taken for granted there because of the small villages and the vast kind of areas. You really only have one maybe student here and one student there. So video conferencing is pretty standard. This image actually is with OCAD. We did a couple years of video conferencing in our history course and theory course with them. This year things are switching and we're doing it the other way around. We're broadcasting out of Dawson City to other communities. Over the Wire, I'm just really briefly going to talk about, it kind of comes out of all of these ideas of communication and pedagogy and the necessity of that in the North. And it's just a quick project that I do every semester with my students that I pair them with an established artist. And the only rule is the artist can't show up in town. They got to stay away, and the instructions for the show, the exhibition, need to be corresponded through some type of communication, either letter writing or email or internet or telephone. Usually it's a combination of all of them. We've worked with Tim in Montreal, Sherry here in Toronto, Gary Hill from Seattle, Ian Baxter from Windsor, and Lawrence Wiener from New York. That's the show that just finished in April. And that was a combination of all of those. He handmailed a letter of the instructions and the work, and then was emailing, and then we had a conference call with the studio in New York, and it's all of this kind of how does it mediate through distances. A kind of picture of the show there, the poster for the Ian Baxter ones, the book we produced with Sherry Boyle, Gary Hill's contribution, and the video installation that he did there. Going to shift gears really quickly, kind of moving along a little slow, perhaps. This is Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow. I just want to read an excerpt from that. Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow is a novel that takes place or set mainly in the last stages of World War II. Here's a dialogue about some fighter pilots. It's a dangerous game Cherry Coke's playing here. Often he thinks the sheer volume of information pouring in through his fingers will saturate, burn him out. She seems determined to overwhelm him with her history and its pain, and the edge of it, always fresh from the stone, cutting his hopes at all their hopes. He does respect her. He knows that very little of this is female theatrics, really. She has turned her face more than once to the outer radiance and simply seen nothing there, and so each time has taken a little more of the zero into herself. Ice crystals swept hissing away from the back edges of wings perilously deep, opening as they were moved into new white abyss. For half a minute, radio silence broke apart. The traffic being. Same place. Freak Show 2, did you see that? Over? Wingman, this is Freak Show 2, affirmative. Same place. Good. No one else on the mission seemed to have radio communication. After the raid, St. Blaise checked over the equipment of those who got back to base and found nothing wrong. All the crystals on frequency, the power supplies, ripless as could be expected. But others somehow remember. For the few moments the visitation lasted, even static vanished from the headphones. These are some, I really like heraldry. This is some patches from World War II. This is the Ghost Squadron of the Canadian 428 Squadron that was bombing from Britain to the Fortress Europe. Here's a photograph of them again with one of their bombs, or I guess more than one, there's a whole bunch. During the Second World War, a lot of the electronic warfare was developed. We had, of course, the oboe, the G, the H2S systems. Some of those are for navigational, so the bombers could find out where they were, to find out where their targets were. With the H2S radar system, they were able to get the first kind of shadow images as a technology. That was quickly developed afterwards in the early 50s in America. In Lincoln Labs down at MIT, they had a workshop in the summer of 51, 52. And they decided one of the major concerns in emergencies was to create some type of warning system around the continent of North America to protect from Russian bombers, as planes were in Second World War as well, radar being developed and planes being able to reach farther and farther distances. So the project that came out of that was two, SAGE and the Dewline. So this is SAGE, Semi-Automatic Ground Environment. Was a large distributed digital real-time surveillance communication and command control system developed in the early 1950s in parallel with the DEW, distant early warning line, at MIT's Lincoln Labs and is the birth of networked radar and systems engineering, which today covers the fields of air traffic control, space surveillance, missile defense offense, air defense, and tactical surveillance. SAGE was the precursor radar system that eventually evolved into BMUs, or ballistic missile early warning, to detect Russian ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, developed out of the theories of 19th century Russian mystic Nikolai Fodorov and the V-2 rocket program. So SAGE was this project of networking all of these radar antennas and information using the computer Whirlwind, some of the first magnetic processing and digital processing ever, to consolidate it all into these command centers to create a digital map through this network of the bogies that would be flying onto the North American continent. Started as in Cape Cod as a prototype, and then at the same time was being developed by the Dew Lines infrastructure to be developed in North America. I mean, at that time they realized that the most likely way for the Russians to bomb America was, of course, over the ice cap, and Canada being the buffer zone between those two superpowers became the likely neighborhood for that electromagnetic boundary to be laid out to protect and to warn. This is a SAGE room. You can see all the radar controllers watching. It takes quite a lot. They're watching these phosphorant screens and watching for aircraft as things kind of come in. Here's a little quick picture of kind of what one of those control centers would look like architecturally and what goes into them. This is a photo just taken last week. This is at MIT on the top of Building 54, one of the first early radomes that was used in these kind of experiments and so forth. It's a fiberglass shell. I was down there for a performance last week for a project I'll talk about at the end of the talk, and doing some research in the archives. And I was working with actually a particle physicist who had transferred into phytoplankton geomodeling of the oceans. I guess physics equations help transfer that. And he was working in the building. He was able to get me onto the roof and take photographs of these objects that are quite early radome structures. So I'm kind of that was a kind of nice gesture of him. And the reason why I wanted to photograph these and kind of do some contact mic recordings and record them is because I've been working with the radome for quite some time. This is a picture on the interior of it. You can see a little bit of the antenna and the translucence of the fiberglass. You'll notice the shape, of course, is almost kind of like a globe with its latitude, longitude, its meridians, and we're yet to kind of go into something which I think is quite radical, and that is the geodesic dome, or the rigid radome that was developed by Buckminster Fuller. This is the first prototype dome from the MIT archives, and it was a collaboration between Buckminster Fuller and Lincoln Labs and the Defense Department. And I'll read a little bit more about that in a second. So it's with this gesture that I want to kind of go from the kind of global meridian sphere type idea to the geodesic housing these radar antennas that I've been wanting to explore for several years. And the reason is, I think the best way to explain this is through a history of Paul Virilio. He has this amazing book that he published in 1975 with an exhibition called Bunker Archaeology. This is one of his black and white photographs of the bunkers that were on the Atlantic coast of Europe to defend against, they were the Nazi bunkers to defend against invasion from the British. The brilliance of Virilio's observations, or let's say his poeticness, is that he looked at these types of architecture as a symbol for the last phase of Occidental military warfare. And what he means by that is essentially shared fronts, or how the bunker was a symbol for a type of warfare that was ending. And I'll read a passage that can explain it much more succinctly than I. This is Paul Virilio. The bunker, the poetry of the bunker is in it still being a shield for its users. In the end is outdated as an infant's rebuilt armor, an empty shell, an emotional, moving phantom of an old-fashioned duel, which the adversaries could still look at each other in the eye through the narrow slits of their helmets. The bunker is the proto-history of an age in which the power of a single weapon is so great that no distance can protect you from it any longer. The bunker is the last theatrical gesture in the end game of Occidental history. And what's interesting about it is that these things don't rely on foundation, but they have a center of gravity unto themselves. And this became for him a certain type of defense that changes radically when you introduce electronic warfare. And as he quotes General Sergei Gershkov, he says, "The winner in the next war will be he who controls the electromagnetic spectrum, or the fourth front of electromagnetic warfare." And the fourth front of warfare being the electromagnetic spectrum, the other one being the sea, land, and the air. So it's with this idea of looking at that, the pre-missile, the pre-ballistics, and the idea that you can cross any geography in the world in a matter of hours renders these types of architecture not very effective. What I wanted to do is kind of do the similar trick. Here's a few more pictures of the bunker. And as well, this is a V2 launching station. That's the V2 rocket there that he's talking about that in a way kind of ended this whole type of warfare where you could reach thousands of kilometers. Well, not this model, but eventually. So what I want to do is I want to look at the geodesic radome as a trope for the last aspect of 20th century warfare, that being the network or the distributed network that is electromagnetic, and how these networks are housed, the eyes of it in these antennas, in these geodesic radomes that share, in a way, a similar architectural principle of distributed tension and compression, and how it is distributed. And I think that's a poetic gesture that, in a way, the radome camouflages what's inside of it. It says you can't see in, but it's also transparent in its electromagnetic properties. And therefore, it kind of all seemed to make sense for me. And this is a little passage on geodesic radomes. First built in Germany prior to the Second World War to house the Zeiss Planetarium in Berlin, the geodesic dome was popularized by its American patent holder, Arbuckminster Fuller. During the 1950s, Fuller collaborated with the MIT's Lincoln Labs and the U.S. Department of Defense to create the first rigid radar domes, or radomes, to house Arctic radar antennas capable of functioning in severe wind, temperature, and ice conditions while being efficient to transport and assemble. The distributed engineering design of the geodesic was a precursor to the ARPANET program, so I argue, and can be seen as a symbol of modern warfare's shift from direct conflict on a shared front to contemporary electromagnetic combat via distributed networks. By the end of the 1960s, the geodesic dome's iconic status as due, distant early warning architecture had been subverted by alternative cultures like Drop City as a means of expressing Fuller's concept of spaceship Earth and ecological concerns. Today, geodesic domes represent the ambiguity of invisible military operations in the electromagnetic realm, as well as counterculture utopias, all while referencing another type of polar dome, the igloo. I think if we take this that kind of passage and put it with this McLuhan quote, it kind of rings true for me. A border is not a connection, but an interval of resonance, and such gaps abound in the land of the dew line. The dew line itself, the distant early warning radar system installed by the United States and the Canadian North to keep this continent in touch with Russia, points up a major Canadian role in 20th century, the role of hidden ground for big powers. Since the United States has become a world environment, Canada has become an anti-environment that renders the United States more acceptable and intelligible to many small countries of the world. Anti-environments are indispensable for making an environment understandable. I'm not going to read the next paragraph, but I'll just pull out some nice words that he says. Small is beautiful, and centralism is felt to be disease. In this new world, the decentralized and soft-focused image of the flexible Canadian identity appears to be a great advantage. Here's a blueprint from the U.S. Air Force of the radome antenna that is Bar 1, one of the prototyped stations in the Yukon. Quick photographs, you can see what's in it, just the antenna with the shell there. Mm-hmm. This is a photograph. The next photographs all come from the Dew Line Archive, which I published last year in conjunction with an exhibition, which is really just a representation of the research by David Neufeld, who's the Western Canadian Arctic historian for Parks Canada. So we kind of consolidated and put it on an archive you can search. So these images are available online if you'd like to see them. This is the station, a scene with the troposcatter antennas I was talking about earlier, and the radome in the background. This is inside of one of the radomes. There again is an operator watching. The neat thing, I think particularly I would just want to mention at this conference, since it's a sound one, is that along with the invention of the rigid radome, they had to invent the first automatic signal detection alarm. Because, of course, the Arctic, they didn't want a lot of people up there, so they had to restrict the personnel. So instead, because there weren't going to be a lot of planes flying up there, usually only ones that weren't necessarily good, they thought they could just do a signal processing and trim off or filter so that when a plane came up, it could cause an alarm and then someone could go inspect it, unlike, let's say, Cape Cod or something like that, where there's a lot of air traffic, commercial air traffic. People have to watch attentively to figure out what's going on. This way, men could go and do other operational duties like maintenance, and then if they heard alarm, they could go. And that's the invention of that, in a sense, of the automatic signal detection and the alarm basis that was developed at MIT specifically for the Arctic and its processes. here's a Doppler antenna kind of to fill in the gaps. This is the McGill radar fence here that was developed at McGill, kind of to in conjunction with MIT's Lincoln Labs. Here's a communication satellite from the, one of the DuSations as well, which always reminds me of that one there. People recognize that image. That's from that landscape, which is planet Hoth, which is from Star Wars 5, which led me to create a term in the last year. Few regions are as visibly marked by the presence of military experimentation and infrastructure as the Arctic, even though ironically there is little if no active combat in the Arctic theater. Because of its involvement in telecommunications, the establishment of settlement outposts, scientific support, mapping, training, and exploration, the military has a long history in the Arctic, perhaps because few other organizations can afford the investment needed to work in the environment or feel the extreme need to be present in the harsh climate, petroleum corporations being the major exception, of course. Spawned by the film Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back, the term Hothian warfare refers to strategies in polar regions that use advanced technology verging on the fantastical. These include, but are not limited to, the alert and due radar stations, the Stratospheric Strategic Defense Initiative, or what Reagan administration called Star Wars, the high-frequency active auroral research project called HARP, patrolling nuclear submarines surfacing through ice pack, remote drones exploring the seabed, and what's on the drawing table at the moment, floating nuclear oil exploration stations off the coast of Russia. I just want to quickly draw attention to the shield generators that get blown up in that film. I think it's just kind of, I don't know, maybe it's personal, but I love how there's this polar region, this Arctic, and they've created this artificial electromagnetic force field at this place to protect them. It's kind of like Halo 3 with its geodesic force field bubble shield that is to protect from, you know, these electromagnetic weapons. And so forth, and it really kind of signals back to this, I think, architectural history, which I find fascinating, popping up in pop culture. So this actually brings me to now talk about my own work, I guess, though a lot of this research I do feel is a lot of the work. I've written a few texts on this, and I see that as part of my practice just as much as the studio work. That brings me to this idea that I've been working with for the last little bit called field work, which has come out of this process. And I just want to define that quickly before I go into giving particular examples of what kind of projects are generated this way. A fieldwork engages with the geographical site, but then warps one's perception of the space comparable to a mathematical strange attractor, sharing on the one hand the history of art installation, which can modulate the encompassing architecture and the viewer's phenomenological perception, and on the other hand, the history of site-specific or earthwork art, which amplifies the place's story or materiality. A fieldwork creates its own temporary architecture within a space or in a landscape. However, such a landscape need not be natural, and the architecture might not always be traditional shelter, but can be composed of soundscapes, electromagnetic fields, light fluctuations, or subjective relationships. At its core, a fieldwork is dynamic and geospatial. So this is just a very abstract way to talk about a studio practice that, in a sense, steals a term from science, and has a lot of fun with sound fields or light fields or magnetic fields or putting yourself in this kind of space that's very alive and dynamic itself and modulating it, of course. So the first piece I want to show in this line of work is the Dew Project, which is presented in the Deep Wireless Festival down the hall in some manner or form. And it's a geodesic pavilion that was in the wilderness of the Yukon that it was off-grid, it was solar-powered, and it's a radio station that was doing environmental recording of the ice underneath of it. It was on the Yukon River, and the water flow underneath of it, it's about a 5 feet thick ice, so that was drilled through and dropped into the water, as well as hydrophones were frozen into the ice itself. And then the sound was broadcast back to my studio and then bounced on the internet so you could hear it anywhere around the world. Obviously referencing a certain type of military history. Oh, and it has a computer-controlled lighting system in it, so it's shifting through the color spectrum in certain reference to the skies above. To make the piece, I did a lot of research, and including both field work up at actual Dew sites. This is on the Beaufort Sea. This is Bar 3, also now known as the North Warning System. And here I'm doing some electromagnetic recordings of the generators and the radar. This is the Beaufort Sea, doing some hydrophone recordings of the ice. Another one here, Again, this is a little bit more of a sound experiment where I was actually projecting sounds into the ice and then recording as it distributed through it, kind of like a seismic kind of play. My father in 1969 was doing seismic in this exact location for oil exploration, so it was a little bit of a personal history to return and do these kind of projects. So this was built as a kind of representation of this kind of history, but then not pointing to the issue of sovereignty in the past, which was questioned by the Dew Line. Of course, a lot of people during this history, of course, some of you will remember, were very concerned that these American military stations were a threat to Canada's sovereignty in the Arctic. It's not very populated, and to have these massive infrastructural sites, you know, threatened a certain discourse around that. I think the future that this project was trying to point to with environmental recordings was more about this issue being revisited 50 years later in the sense of the issues of sovereignty in the Arctic and the UN claims with Article 97 of extension of the EE zone according to your continental shelf. So we'll get into that again kind of at the end. But that's what this project was dealing with. I'm now working through it in a certain way of representing it off-site in galleries or museums. This is one example of it, and I take one of the projects was to kind of essentially put this modernist type sculpture in the Arctic landscape, which is very white and a surrogate kind of white cube. This was a reverse where I kind of took the, something out of the Arctic landscape and put it back into the gallery and really started to reference 60s sculpture with the monolithic solar panels and the Buckminster Fuller Radome that changed from a pavilion that you could actually go in and be sheltered and listen with headphones to the water flowing under your feet to it being a entity that was locked and you can't enter in the gallery and it functions purely as sculpture. I'm just going to quickly play a 3-minute excerpt. Along with this performance in the archive, the Parks Canada archive, was a 20-minute audiovisual performance that had a video of a lot of the research and almost a cataloging of different types of communication antennas that exist in the Arctic that were recorded in Northwest Territories, Yukon, and Alaska. And then a live soundtrack was produced using record transmissions from the station that was actually going during the time. So I'll play this, and just for a couple minutes, you kind of get an idea of what that was like. The sound you're hearing is a mix of shortwave scans, some light recordings, what else is in there right now? Some electromagnetic recordings of just different kind of systems up there. That's HARP. That's in Tacoma, Alaska. It's the ionospheric heater, and that's one of the signals. That's also HARP. Some more antennas from there. Microwave power, you see them all through the Arctic, it's how the internet and telephones are communicated. Another one that's on the border between the Yukon and the Northwest Territory. I'll just let that play in the background. You can watch the full video in the installation, I think at lunch or in the evening this evening. It's a 12-minute video. So I won't show much of that here because you can access that at a later time. This is just a pan in the tombstones where a lot of the Northern Lights recordings came from. It's just another microwave tower there. I'm going to keep moving here. This is just an installation shot of the Magnetic North Show, which the Dew Project was an experiment for putting it in the gallery, but I don't think I really need to talk too much about the idea of the Arctic and the white cube so much, and that was a reference I might have gone with Yves Klein's Void Room from 1958, but we won't go there. This is Alert. In Nunavut, it's the tip of Ellesmere Island. It's the most northern permanent settlement in the world, and it's a project I'm working on at the moment. I'm currently working with the Canadian military as a war artist to be kind of actualized in the next year and a bit. So trying to work on getting there. And it's mainly, it was originally a listening station in the 1950s, because it's actually closer to Moscow than it is to Ottawa. But nowadays, it's mainly like meteorological equipment for gravitational, electromagnetic readings and this type of stuff. I think I got a question from Anna Frizz about a year ago about number stations. So I thought I'd play that, because that's been rather influential, I would say, for sure, in regards to this kind of thinking of radio and the Cold War. For those of you who don't know, number stations are these spy stations that transmit on a schedule of numbers every once in a while, and they're to be decoded for messages, and you can kind of hear them and try to interpret them, but they're just these strange recordings. But this one particularly is really beautiful. It doesn't even need any mixing or anything. It's just gorgeous. That recording was from Black Cat Systems. That always makes me feel of Fredrik Jørgensen and EVP. So I thought I'd throw in a little book there that was published a few years ago. Fredrik Jørgensen was one of the pioneers of that kind of Victorian mentality of being able to access the spirit world, kind of like Victorian photography, spirit photography, right? That you could get a photograph and see your dead baby or your relative. He's that continuation, basically, in the 50s and so on, that thought that, or I shouldn't say thought, believed, that with his tape recorder, electromagnetic recorder, he could record voices from the other side. I just want to read this one passage from him, which applies to the talk today. Suddenly I had the urge to do a tape recording with strange impulse, because I hardly ever searched for radio contact after 10 p.m., but this time I turned on the tape recorder. Since I knew from experience that Lena could not be reached late in the evening, and I did not turn the dial but left everything to chance, there was not the slightest interference, so no hissing sound, static voices, or music. Suddenly I heard a metallic switching sound, and a male voice known to me called out, no, recited clear and sharp in a kind of half-song. And excuse me if I don't speak these languages, but Berkenat and Mol. I don't know, maybe somebody help me in the audience. Molno, we are waiting for Lena. Then the voice of my childhood friend Berkard came through and chanted clearly, Lena has Sweden. He mispronounced Sweden as Sweringen instead of the correct name Sveringen, which was typical for him. After a little while came a soft switching sound, and then Lena's voice, and a little apologetically, so many people. Afterwards, it became entirely still. Was it one of these mystical radar contacts of which Lena spoke so frequently? At this point, I would like to clarify a concept that can otherwise lead to much misunderstanding. By radar, a radar screen, one normally understands a movable antenna like the instrument that emits electromagnetic impulses in certain directions. These impulses are reflected back like an echo to their point of origin. If they hit a compact mass, aircraft, mountain, or cloud, and indicate the object they have hit by means of illuminated points on the radar screen. In case of darkness or fog, the radar screen serves as a substitute for the human eye. If the departed used a similar instrument, it would mean that our world and we are normally invisible to, the other side. In this connection, I recall a communication that I recorded here in Pompeii in the spring of 1967. It was a clear male voice that said somewhere forced and hurriedly, Ilya and Fredil, we know your thoughts. We receive them with the radar. I regret today that I was not trained in electronics and physics. I am sure that an experienced physicist could improve communication with the dead significantly by means of directional antennas, filters, and loudspeakers. And I love how like the last metaphor of his whole book on EVP is radar. Which brings me to the last aspect of the projects that I'll talk about today, which is the Ghost Rockets World Tour. which is a site-specific series that tactically maps the history of ballistics from the birth of military rocketry to Europe with MIT, through MIT laboratories and the NASA space program to U.S. military bases in the desert and DARPA research stations in the Arctic. Under the guise of a rock and roll world tour, each site hosts a rocket launch spectacle with video documentation and satellite objects. The namesake of the series stems from UFO sightings in Scandinavia post-World War II, usually attributed to secret Russian launches of commandeered V-2 rockets over the Baltic Sea. So this was the counterpoint. I spent a few years researching radar and this curtain or electromagnetic boundary that was spread across the Arctic. And why was that? What is the counterpoint to that? Was because of the ballistic missile and the V-2 rocket and this change in warfare that way. Those are the major shifts, that networking and this long distance of speed. So it made sense. I was doing a residency at the Atlantic Center for the Arts last May, about a month after the Dew Line was first mounted. And I wanted to watch rocket launches there, obviously. It's at Cape Canaveral, and kind of got in my system, and it seemed like just a good idea to do a spectacle of light shows. I was growing crystals on seashells, listening to Dark Side of the Moon every morning. And I thought, why not I create a rock and roll spectacle? Instead of using a smoke machine, I'll just launch a rocket in the theater, and the smoke from the rocket will, you know, densify the air, and it'll work great. It took me a couple tries before I didn't get stuck in the roof, and it stayed on the stage. It worked out, and it was a lot of fun. And then I kind of went a step backwards, and I thought, why don't I just actually launch them and not worry about them not going anywhere? Sorry, this is an image from that performance down in Florida. And it was like a mix of vinyl records and projections and lots of fun. Moved on to Berlin, where the birth of military rocketry was, at Tegel. Because of the Treaty of Versailles, of course, the Germans couldn't build an air force. And so rockets were not yet invented, really. So that was a great way to work in the artillery section and build something that wasn't a kind of a loophole in the treaty. So we all know Wernher von Braun and his contribution there. This is a launch that was at Teufelsberg, just in West Berlin, which actually was a U.S. military spy station after it was a Nazi technical military college, and then was bought by David Lynch for a transcendental meditation yogic flying training center. So there's lots of mysticism wrapped up in the history of rockets, which is always fun. This is the Mojave Desert. This is Edwards Air Force Base and Rocket Ridge, where they do a lot of development prototype ballistics. In the background, where I'm actually launching it is in the only civilian corridor of airspace jurisdiction where you can actually go to space. And this is where Virgin and so forth are now building their launch pad for space tourism. I can show a little video.
Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition, and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade.
Anyways, lots of fun. They're all choreographed pop or rock and roll songs that have to do, obviously, with the military or space during usually the Cold War. I usually use on-sound location for the recordings and some pyrotechnics and so forth. This one was really quickly done in the Mojave Desert because, well, there were helicopters coming. And so these are the ways I archive it with these satellite objects. These are the burnt launch pads from the launch sites. That one's from Florida. That one, I can't remember where that's from. Maybe that's the one that was up in the Arctic. And I'll quickly get to the point of how this relates to what I'm talking about and isn't just kind of fun traveling and collaborations. This is HAARP, which I've mentioned several times throughout the performance today. And it stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. It's a DARPA-funded initiative that's managed by the U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy. It's kind of the Moby Dick of conspiracy theories if you're into that these days. I'm not a conspiracist. It's a straight-up real place. I went there. It's actually only about 5 hours from where I live. And no one really knows what's going on there, which is kind of the strange part. And there's theories that it's everything from communications experimentation with nuclear submarines, because it can deeply penetrate the ocean so they don't have to surface, to its ground-penetrating radar to see subsurface structures, all the way to, you know, Chavez, how do we say this, charged the Americans for causing the earthquake in Haiti with an experiment from this place, or weather manipulation. It modifies the ionosphere, and they don't know really how it works. They're very upfront about that. If you watch the interviews from the public relations department in regards to this this project, this is this nice Mosquito Coast generator that powers this massive array of antennas. And you can go all Tesla if you want to and talk about different conspiracies and so forth. It could also just be a redevelopment of the Star Wars initiative, or SDI, that was cut but then kind of earmarked through black funding as an intercontinental ballistic shield. No one really knows. Also, I think just like the University of Alaska professors can probably use it for something. That's the beauty of it, it's the electromagnetic. So they have a video camera that's there, right? You can always watch webcam HARP. They have their own website, of course. They have open houses too, but they've never actually happened. They advertise it, and I call them every year, and they say, oh, no, not this year. So we had to go a little guerrilla style and get some footage. But that's the beauty of it. You can look at it, and nothing's going on. But, of course, everything that's going on is not something you see, which is a nice little irony, I think, there. And so a rocket launch was also done there, kind of mapping out this modern or contemporary extension of electromagnetic warfare in the Arctic. This is the performance I did just last week in MIT with Hasib Ahmed, who is a fellow I was also with in Berlin last summer. He's working at an architecture firm there in Berlin. And it was called remote viewing. It was called Devil, and it was a two-part thing. We did this remote viewing session with these researchers from EAPS, or the Environmental Atmospheric Planetary Sciences Department at MIT, who do remote sensing, such as accumulating data to create these maps of what will happen, prediction maps. This fellow was working with phytoplankton, as I mentioned earlier. So we had them do this remote sensing. For those of you who know who remote sensing is, it's that idea where if you believe in a planetary consciousness, you should be able to access someone else's consciousness and look through their eyes in a different geographic location. So this was something experimented with in the 70s for espionage purposes with the US military. I don't know if it really went anywhere, but it was tried out. So we did that with the Berlin site, because MIT, of course, as I mentioned earlier, with Lincoln Labs, is the birth of a lot of this technology that went to Berlin in the Teufelsberg NSA spy station, with the radomes and the antenna and the listening. So we wanted to kind of have these geographical links in two different places. So this is a 60-screen kind of audiovisual performance that went with the remote viewing. There you can see the model V2 rocket. There's some more visualizations there. These are the remote viewers down here. And then those drawings were loaded into the nose of the rocket, and we launched them from the Strata Amphitheater, which is the one built by Frank Gehry. It's the AI building, and we didn't really ever find it, so who knows. I think it landed on the roof of the Gehry building. I'm not really sure. I kind of like it, though. There were like four search parties that went out to find it, because it kind of veered off. I don't really launch heavy things in the nose cone, but it was this collaboration with this fellow, and he really wanted to put these drawings in, and I was like, okay, you got to use like onion paper or newsprint or something, and you know, he was burnt out and he just needed some paper and got in a fight with a colleague, so we just used normal scrap, all these little things. But this paper is very heavy compared to some, so we put them in and the rocket kind of veered a little bit, and it all worked out, but we just told people it was supposed to do that. One of the reasons why also rocketry, to kind of close the talk today, is this is a Soyuz rocket. It's a Russian rocket. This is the launch that launched the RADARSAT-2, which is a Canadian satellite that's being used for surveillance of the Arctic region. Eventually, in a couple of years, they're hoping to get the whole RADARSAT constellation system set up so they can actually observe the North. Right now, as we, or some of you might be aware of, with the ice cap melting, the Northwest Passage opening up, and this slicing of the pie up there for territory with different countries, we can't actually protect our own sovereignty. We can't even surveil it and see who's there and what's going on. So this is kind of a mad dash for us to get some observational satellites up there so we can see what is going on. And this is a launch. Ironically, we're using a Russian rocket to be surveilling that territory, which a couple of years ago, of course, we were doing surveillance for the exact opposite of those rockets kind of coming towards us. This is a quick map of from the International Boundary and Research Unit from England, and they've got this beautiful map that shows the disputed territories in the north and all the different countries. You can download it off their website. It's quite beautiful. And then there's a whole second page of annotations of what this color coding means. Everything from this little disputed territory right here between Canada and America in the Beaufort Sea, which, you know, if 20% of the oil reserves of the world are up there, that's an expensive piece of real estate. So we'll see how that works out. Of course, the Americans aren't, ratifying the UN treaty for extension of the coastal line. Everyone's madly collecting scientific data. The Russians have submitted theirs, and that was actually rejected recently. So Canada has a few more years before they submit their reports on their scientific findings to see how much of the ocean they can claim for development. So that kind of brings us full circle to the dew line and the rockets and how they kind of fit together for issues of sovereignty up there. And just to end it on the aspect of we finally move up again into space with the Northern Lights and satellites and this kind of, you know, obviously the infrared and the electromagnetism of light being part of that surveillance system and then, of course, being broadcast back down to Earth. So I'll end with this rocket launch that was up the dew line. This is kind of the same place that I did the research for the field recordings. This one I built a wireless camera into the rocket and so that I could get an aerial video of the site because I am trying to map these sites out. And the rocket goes about Mach 3 and eventually you'll notice there's interference in the wire signal. That's from the radar station that's going around. You'll notice there's a pattern. It's cyclical, and then it wipes out the signal altogether. This is a 2-minute excerpt.
Was exceptional, wouldn't you say, Steve?
I'm sorry, I was just too busy trying to come up with some clever thing to say about like a Stankovich or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, if banal and regular talking is the norm, then I will say again, this was an exception. An exception.
Nicholas, did you just let out a Stankovich? I'm sorry. Sorry, Charles. No, I'm sure our guest is actually through painful years in middle school and high school and probably junior school and primary school had every version of his last name and its unfortunate phonic associations brought up to him. So I'm going to stop thinking about that right now, actually.
Yep, I would agree. You know, I was kind of struck when he started talking about that U.S. collaboration on the Dew Project, something as a United States citizen I had never heard of, which actually doesn't surprise me. Here in the U.S., I'm never surprised when I find out that our military has been doing something strange, unusual, and oftentimes cruel without my knowledge. Do you guys suffer from the same sort of thing in your experience, Steve, in Canada?
Well, I think the Canadian assumption is that the American military is also doing something strange and maybe sinister without anyone's knowledge as well, if that's what you mean. And in terms of the Canadian military, I just think there's a complete lack of awareness of its existence, really. The Canadian military is not the same kind of all-present, all-powerful organization within Canada that the American military is within the United States. So to be fair, I only thought about the military for the first time, really, when my cousin joined. Otherwise, it had been sort of the kind of thing you maybe understood to be there, but really had almost no direct awareness of at all. So, I mean, in America, at least you know that there's a military, whereas it's kind of a big mystery in Canada.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I just assume that the United States military is doing awful things all the time without my knowledge.
Right, that's like an X-Files thing, I think, maybe more than anything. That just means that you watch a lot of TV. I think one of the things that Charles's talk really brings home is that the United States military is actually the leading and most progressive in some ways arts commissioning organization in the world, maybe. I mean, the NEA sponsors the odd project here and there, but it's all from really stock art angles. And meanwhile, here you have the Army doing intense work with the Northern Lights. And they admit that this is entirely experimental, that they don't know exactly what's happening. And this is just the kind of experimental, forward-thinking, advanced kind of practice that would, you know, turn Robert Smithson inside out. It's the kind of thing that is only to be dreamt of. And yet, really, we're considering it as a military exercise as opposed to just another kind of interesting human behavior that very well could qualify, I think, as contemporary art. And here we go, broadcasting an artist talk. And listeners at home might not be aware of this, but both Nicholas and I are in the life, quote unquote. You know, we're still in doing the job in the contemporary art field. So artist talks are something that we have, you know, justifiably avoided over the course of our time here, over more than a year hosting the talking show. And in large part, just because of the grinding familiarity of them, I've gotten to give artist talks all over the world. And the idea of hearing someone else do one almost has a painful familiarity as opposed to a tang of pleasant remembrance. So I think what's interesting here is that instead of this being, you know, work that is happening, you know, by the grace of, let's say, Kunsthalle Munich or something like that, instead, we're looking at work that happens because of the Department of Defense. Wouldn't you agree that it's actually maybe some of the most interesting work I've ever heard about that I didn't know about, and it was being done by the military?
Yeah. Listening to Charles' talk made me think a lot about the position of sound and art, because you could see from his body of work that he's moved from a solidly kind of sound art context into more sculptural and site-specific sort of work, still including sound, but definitely a broader range of media. And someone coming from a composition background, I think about the position of sound in contemporary art, you know. And I had a very strange experience the last time I was in Berlin. I was thinking about how Susan Phillips, whose name I probably can't pronounce, had won the Turner Prize, who was solidly a sound artist, and the kind of gaining of momentum of sound as a respectable medium in contemporary art. And so I posed this question to Ursula Block, who runs the Gelbe Musik shop in Berlin, which is a very famous store known for carrying avant-garde and experimental sound stuff since the 80s, that she opened with her husband, the gallerist René Block, responsible for things like the Block editions and showing some important people like Joseph Beuys and that, you know, that one guy, Marcel Duchamp. And I asked her, I said, what do you think about this? Do you think it's gaining momentum? Is there a tipping point coming? And she said very pessimistically that she didn't believe it was, that it's always been this way, that the art world has always been curious about sound, that it's always been relegated to a secondary role and will never, ever see the bright light of the market. What do you have to say about that, Steve?
Well, it sounds pretty reasonable to me, actually. That sounds like a canny and knowledgeable opinion.
Yeah. Well, it hits kind of close to home, you know. Well, wonderful talking here tonight by Charles Stankovich. This is The Talking Show, signing off. Have a gentle night, Los Angeles.